From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we hear scenes from Detroit where fans of Aretha Franklin are gathering to say their goodbyes. Then Operation Finale director Chris Weitz on how a young girl's relationship with her boyfriend led to the capture of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann in Argentina.
Her father, as it happens, was a blind concentration camp survivor. But he realized, it dawned upon him, that this boy was actually the son of Adolf Eichmann.
And we meet the first Cuban musician to get a coveted scholarship at the Berklee School of Music. All that coming up on The Frame. Today, fans of Aretha Franklin began paying their respects to the Queen of Soul at the Museum of African American History in Detroit. This morning, a huge crowd gathered to greet her gold casket. It arrived in a white Cadillac hearse, the very same vehicle that carried her father in 1984 and Rosa Parks in 2005. Quinn Kleinfelter of WDET in Detroit was there reporting. I spoke with him about the scene.
Inside the doors in the Wright Museum of African American History, Aretha Franklin was laid out, according to many people, as they would expect a queen to be. She was in red. It was an open casket. She looked very stately and quite like what everybody would remember her as, the Queen of Soul. Outside, however, it was a bit different than you might imagine. When I think of a public visitation, I think of something rather somber. And in fact, the Reverend Jesse Jackson gave an impromptu talk where he mentioned in a very tearful manner about how he held her hand for the last time and described that situation. Apart from that, though, there was really, it was an atmosphere very similar to a concert. There were people selling T-shirts. They were selling programs. They were hawking her greatest hits. And people really, while they were there to pay their respects, they were also very obviously celebrating her life and the echoes that it had made in their own lives.
What was the crowd like? And did you get a sense that people had traveled great distances to be there to pay their respects?
They had. In fact, there were a number of people who came from distances far and wide. People from Chicago, Tennessee. There was several people, and there was like thousands of people that were lined up to get in. I ran into a guy named A. Brandon Starks, who is actually a funeral director himself from Nashville, Tennessee. But he says what really drew him was not only the music, but the fact that both Aretha and her father, who was a well-known reverend, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, had made a long-lasting impact on the civil rights movement. In particular, the Reverend Franklin helped fund the movement at times. Aretha Franklin had sang at Martin Luther King's funeral and had stuck up for both the rights of women and the rights of African Americans in general.
When they talk about the song Respect, they see it as an anthem for women. But I think that because of her involvement in the civil rights movement, it transcends gender and it's more about respect as a human being. And being a person of color, she understood that because she had come through during the times of segregation, during a time when African Americans weren't afforded equal rights.
It sounds in the background like it's almost a carnival, a circus atmosphere. Once you got into the museum, was any music being played? Did you hear some of Aretha's own music?
Yeah, it was a more of a somber thing in that respect. But, you know, outside, it was very much a celebration. I mean, the songs were playing very loudly. Police were actually there to keep things under control. There was what is designed to be a caravan of pink Cadillacs. And there were people that said how she had been, in many ways, a mirror of what they themselves had gone through in their own lives. One woman that really stuck out to me is from Detroit and really seemed to exemplify what many people in Detroit seem to be thinking. Her name's Myrtis Hamlet.
I saw something in her that I've never seen in another female singer, even way back in 67. It just seemed like when she didn't talk with the arrogance. It was like a more of a humble. You would never have seen it in Diana Ross, no offense, but she never forgot that she was from Detroit. And she's always here helping out. She gave money to the music department for Detroit Public School. I worked there for 31 years, so God was with her. She's with him now.
I want to ask you more about her legacy in Detroit, how the city is planning to memorialize her life and her music.
The city itself is holding a number of events. There'll be another visitation coming up at the same place now that they're doing it, at the Wright Museum of African American History. They'll do a half a day of a visitation at the New Bethel Baptist Church. And then later that evening, they'll have a tribute concert tour. This is all on Thursday. And the concert itself features some Motown legends, people like the Four Tops, also R&B and gospel. It spans the entire genres, or at least it's designed to, that she was such a part of in so many ways. And then Friday is the actual funeral. And there's going to be a lot of star power there. People, musicians, the likes of Stevie Wonder and Faith Hill, and just about almost two dozen acts that will be performing off and on throughout the time at Greater Grace, and a number of speakers whose lives that she had touched. Smokey Robinson, who grew up, you know, basically just around the block from Aretha Franklin, and both became music superstars kind of together as they grew up. He'll be giving a tribute to her and talking. And so will former President Bill Clinton, who has often talked about Aretha Franklin, actually, in a number of places. And she had sang for both of his inaugural ceremonies. So there's going to be this whole outpouring of all that. And the ironic thing, again, perhaps, is that the Greater Grace Temple, one of the main things that it had done back in the day, when you talk about the Civil Rights Movement, was it had, back in 2005, I believe, they had a huge service there for civil rights icon Rosa Parks, which again had people like the Clintons and others. And the ironic thing from that is that Aretha had sang at the Rosa Parks Memorial, and here she'll be being memorialized at the same exact temple.
Quinn Kleinfelter is senior news editor at WDET in Detroit, where he joined us. Quinn, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new movie looks into the kidnapping and capture of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann in Argentina.
Through every day.
Through every day.
Yes, he will.
15 years after World War II ended, a group of Israeli agents set off on a nearly impossible mission to capture Nazi officer Adolf Eichmann from his hiding spot in Argentina.
If it is Eichmann, they will attempt to get a positive photo ID.
Why didn't you ask me? Aharon is an interrogator.
Precisely. I wanted someone who would interrogate the evidence rather than just shoot at it. This is strictly catch and extract.
That was Nick Kroll and Oscar Isaac, who play Mossad agents Rafi Eitan and Peter Malkin in the film Operation Finale. Directed by Chris Weitz, the movie gives viewers a close look at the cat-and-mouse chase between agents from Israel's Shin Bet and Mossad and the Nazi who was a key architect of the Holocaust. When I spoke with Weitz, we began with Eichmann's reputation in Hitler's army.
Eichmann's area of expertise was in Jewish affairs, and he would travel around Europe organizing the cooperation of various local authorities and the trains and concentration camp officials in making the Holocaust as we know it happen.
And he was, really sad to say, very good at his job. I mean, in the last couple of days of World War II, he got 400,000 Hungarian Jews into Auschwitz. I mean, he was ruthlessly skilled in the horrible thing that he was doing.
He was extremely efficient, as well as in some ways being an example of banality of evil. You know, Hannah Arendt's famous phrase. I think he was more than that. I think he was a very skilled, talented, ambitious careerist who did his job extremely well and to the end was proud of his abilities in working for the state.
Hannah Arendt covered his trial for The New Yorker. He was briefly in American custody after the end of the war, but thanks to some forged documents and, most startlingly, a humanitarian passport issued by the International Committee of the Red Cross, moves to Argentina in 1950, and he almost gets away. What happens? How does his fate change? And what happens almost 10 years later?
It's pretty extraordinary the way that he was found out. A young girl, Argentinian girl called Sylvia Herman, met a boy, fell in love with him, and took him back to meet her father. Her father, as it happens, was a blind concentration camp survivor who had decided to raise his daughter as a Catholic, not wanting her to face everything that he had. But he realized, it dawned upon him, that this boy was actually the son of Adolf Eichmann. And he reported as much to Fritz Bauer, who is a West German prosecutor. Fritz Bauer did not trust the ability of either the Argentinian government or the West German government to pursue this appropriately, and so took the information to the Mossad.
So we should say right now, Argentina at that time was not only anti-Semitic, but the Catholic Church in many ways enabled Nazi war criminals to live there and not be caught, including Dr. Joseph Mengele.
The Catholic Church at the time saw communism, global communism, as a greater threat than fascism, which had been defeated, let alone the fact that there was a homegrown version of Argentinian fascism, just as there had been a German one, just as there had been an Italian one, Spanish one. And the Argentinian variant was about the connection of the church and the state.
So Eichmann is captured and kidnapped, but owing to a number of technical, logistical problems, is not taken out of the country for more than a week. And in that intervening period, he is held in a safe house. And your movie focuses a lot on conversations that Eichmann, who's played by Penn Kingsley, has with Peter Malkin, who's played by Oscar Isaac in the film. And those conversations are, as you cite in some ways, about the banality of evil, but they also reveal something else. Why were they important to your film, and where did you get that information that informs those conversations?
Well, they're kind of the core of the movie, this psychological struggle between the two of them. It was taken, the idea of it and much of the content of it is taken from Peter Malkin, Oscar Isaac's character, Peter Malkin's memoir called Eichmann in My Hands, in which Peter Malkin describes not only his childhood and his sense of loss, his beloved sister having been killed during the Holocaust, but his deep curiosity about Eichmann and how someone could possibly partake in a crime like this, and also his decision to elicit from Eichmann's compliance by opening up to this man, by talking about his past with him.
We're talking with Chris Weitz about his new film, Operation Finale. I want to ask you a little bit about how Eichmann saw himself and whether or not statements that he made were authentic or geared toward getting some sort of reaction or treatment, because toward the end of the war, Eichmann said, and I'm quoting him now, he would leap laughing into the grave because the feeling that he had 5 million people on his conscience would be for him a source of extraordinary satisfaction.
Yeah.
And yet, when he saw that he was probably going to be put to death, he said, there's a need to draw a line between the leaders responsible and the people like me forced to serve as mere instruments in the hands of a leader. I was not a responsible leader, and as such, do not feel myself guilty.
Well, I was at the Holocaust Museum a few days ago, and amongst other things they addressed really beautifully is how little punishment those who refused to do their jobs suffered. For instance, if soldiers in one of the mobile killing squads refused to do their duty, very little happened to them. This notion that they were forced to do what they did is a bit off to me. And as you can see from both of those quotations, his approach to the truth was deeply self-serving and provisional. There was a certain sort of pride or self-esteem or self-regard in him. And yet I think it's very difficult to arrive at what his actual feelings were on any of these issues. His ways of addressing the truth would shift constantly. And I think you see that in the film, that he is trying on various modes of defense, manipulation, and storytelling in order to try to seize some kind of control of the narrative. I don't think that he actually had any sort of remorse that would matter to us. I think that the record of his behavior during the period show that he was pretty avid in his pursuit of his career and his job.
There are some twists and turns in the real story that I suspect had you written a fictional script, people who give notes on these sorts of things would say, that doesn't seem credible. There's no way that would have happened. Were there moments of this story that are true that you literally had to persuade people that it actually happened, that it was not Hollywood hokum?
Yeah, I think the most Hollywood-seeming plot twist is the blind Holocaust survivor who realizes that his dinner guest is the son of Adolf Eichmann. That's pretty extraordinary. The girl who doesn't know that she's Jewish, who falls in love with a Nazi. Later, this Holocaust survivor is arrested, and the official reason given is that he's suspected of being Josef Mengele, which was kind of a strange form of trolling, I think. A way of saying, we know what you're up to, and you're going to pay a price for this. So there were, and also the method of extraction, which seems extraordinarily far-fetched, that you would dress up the logistician of the Holocaust as a Jewish Israeli, drug him up and get him out on a plane in plain sight, as it were.
One of the things that I think is worth noting is that the team that Israel sent to capture Eichmann and bring him back included virtually everybody on the team had been touched by the Holocaust in some way. They'd lost family, they'd lost siblings, parents. And yet, even though they probably very much wanted to kill Eichmann for what he had done, not only to their family, but to Europe, they knew at some level that bringing him to justice was the more important and moral act to do. How did they wrestle with that?
They knew that satisfying their own personal desire for revenge would be ethically irresponsible, as opposed to bringing this man back in order to face justice in front of the world. On some level, they knew that the national interest was served by putting him in front of television cameras and allowing eyewitnesses of the Holocaust to testify about it for the first time. And this was really the first time the world experienced that, because the Nuremberg trials had been document-based and actually quite closed. You know, when you see Eichmann at the trial, not only is he guarded by a bulletproof glass booth, but the two guards inside the glass booth with him were specifically chosen to be Jews of Iraqi descent who were unlikely to have lost people during the Holocaust. Such was the fear, I suppose, of people wanting to take revenge that they tried to ensure against it. Now, imagine the restraint that it took for these Mossad agents who had this man captive for 10 days in a safe house to keep him alive, and in some cases to interact with him as a human being.
Chris Weitz is the director of Operation Finale. Chris, thanks for coming in. Great to see you.
Thank you so much. Great to see you too.
Operation Finale opens in theaters this Wednesday, August 29th. Coming up on The Frame, we meet a Cuban musician who's a rising star in the United States. And now, the pianist Dairamir Gonzalez is the first Cuban national to receive the prestigious presidential scholarship from the Berklee School of Music in Boston. He's 34 years old, and he's a rising star with humble beginnings and a solid music education. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos caught up with Gonzalez during a recent visit to Los Angeles, which soon might be his new home.
On a recent weeknight in a small club tucked inside a shopping mall in Woodland Hills, pianist Dairamir Gonzalez and his trio opened their first set with a blistering Afro-Cuban tune. The room of about 50 people responded with excitement. Most of the audience didn't know much about Gonzalez. After all, this was the first time he'd played this club. But they learned one thing. He's an extremely talented musician. Dairamir Gonzalez grew up in one of Havana's poorest neighborhoods, El Cerro. His father played trumpet in the legendary dance band, Conjunto Rumbabana. Gonzalez remembers vividly when the group would rehearse at his home. He was 10 years old.
Like sitting, watching the chart of the piano and seeing the mapping. Okay, you come introduction, repeat it 4 times, go to A, B, from B go to coda, coda repeat here, and then montuno. On cue, this, check out how to be aware of the cue of the leader. All of that seems that no one can teach you that unless you experience of yourself in first hand.
When Gonzalez was in eighth grade, he wrote his first composition.
Mi salsa blue, da, pa, 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 mi salsa blue, ah, ah. Tiene su swing y su onda cubana, mi salsa blue, parara. Very simple, but I already had that inclination.
That talent did not go unnoticed. In 2001, at age 16, Gonzalez got his first big break. Oscar Valdez, a member of the renowned band Iraquere, invited him to join another group he had at the time. After playing with Valdez for 3 years, Gonzalez joined a band led by another major figure, Giraldo Piloto. Gonzalez says he learned from both Valdez and Piloto how to be a leader and how to handle musicians.
How to handle when you're on the stage and having 16 members and you have to be very strong to give cue, very clear direction with enough time. This stuff that you have to learn, since I was very inclining to be a leader myself, I was learning from the maestro quietly.
Then, in 2008, Gonzalez got a call to play in one of Cuba's top dance bands, Habana de Primera. The concept behind this band was to assemble all the top in-demand musicians.
The top of the top. So everybody was fighting to have an spot. And I got it.
While he was on tour in Europe with Habana de Primera, Gonzalez got an email from a music publishing company. They were awarding $1 million to support 7 presidential scholarships at Berklee College of Music in Boston.
But un negrito del cerro, you know, a black guy from cerro, this is not going to happen.
In February 2010, Gonzalez and 7 other Cuban musicians were selected to audition in Mexico City. He was among hundreds of applicants vying for one of the 7 scholarships. To prepare for the audition, Gonzalez practiced something he learned from Tony Perez, a Cuban pianist he once saw in concert in Havana. He noticed that during the concert, Perez took out a pen from his pocket and started tapping the Cuban clave on top of the piano with his left hand.
And then with the right hand improvising, pa, pa, pondigito to pile, pendigito to pompano, pipe, papi, po, papi, pile, dondigito to tina, tiny, lendigita, super virtuoso with a lot of contrapoint, with a lot of rumba, quinto, thin. I said, wow, people were like, whoa. What's that? And I practiced that for like 2 weeks, not stopping, because I wanted to bring that special thing to the Berklee audition.
Gonzalez says that hard work paid off. He got the scholarship.
I became the first Cuban national in the entire country, Cuban national living in Havana, to ever attend to Berklee.
The 3 years he spent studying at Berklee, plus all those years playing with some of the top Cuban dance bands, are reflected in his U.S. debut recording called The Grand Concourse. The album was released last June on a small label, Machat Records. Gonzalez says he didn't want to present himself as only a piano player. He wants to show the world what Cuban music is today.
Cuba is a palette of classical with strong Yoruba tradition, with conga, santiaguera, with cha-cha-cha, with danzón, with timba, with funk, with R&B, with jazz harmonies, with blues.
But Gonzalez says being a Cuban musician and composing Cuban music also encompasses many other things.
With politics, with Fidel Castro, with being hungry, with being resilient, with being, I want to get out of Cuba. I cannot leave Cuba. I wish I could leave Cuba to see something.
After attending the Berklee program, Gonzalez has remained in the U.S., but he insists that he didn't defect. He says he's here for the sake of his career. He currently lives in New York, but he has family in Los Angeles and says he plans to move here within a year. Dairamir Gonzalez is living the title of this song from his album, Moving Forward. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
Y
That's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.